this position of bowing, prostration. Which in the Vietnamese and Thich Nhat Hanh tradition we call touching the earth. Wherever I do it, whether it's a Vietnamese temple, a Chinese temple, a Zen center, or in the yard at home, it is such a profound position of non-harming. In early Buddhism, this position was referred to as my five limbs are touching the earth. And in that position, I can do no harm. My head is touching the earth, my both arms are touching the earth, and my legs are touching the earth. So my five limbs can do no harm either to myself or to you. It's a profound position of practice when we understand that what we're doing is we're reminding and training our heart and mind and nervous system in non-harming. Ahimsa. Ahimsa.
Is that me?
That's okay.
Sorry, I'm harmed.
Good morning, dear Thay and dear Sangha. Such a pleasure to be here and to be in an urban Zen temple. I'm just so inspired by being here. We practice in so many old Boy Scout camps, Girl Scout camps, Jewish camps, Catholic seminaries. So this is a rare treat. Because you can really feel it, can't you? You can feel the body of practice that is growing here and deepening in each of us just being here and dedicating this place for the Dharma. So I'm grateful for your practice. So today, we were going to look at tying things up a little from this weekend where our theme has been cultivating beloved community. Yesterday, we looked at resources, so I wanted to tie that up. And surprisingly, I wanted to talk about prostration. Maybe not so surprising. Thich Nhat Hanh married Larry and I in Plum Village in 1994. It was an accident. Let me explain. I wrote Thay and wanted to know what a Buddhist service was. I wrote in the letter that I'd been widowed and I wondered how this was approached in a Buddhist ceremony. And so I sent this letter and then I got this answer back that said, Thich Nhat Hanh cannot marry you. So I wrote again. I said, well, I'm really not asking Thich Nhat Hanh to marry us. I really want to understand what a Buddhist service would be. And so kind of wrote the same letter again. And then I got this same response. Thich Nhat Hanh is too busy to marry you. So I wrote again. And I said, well, I just want to know about a service, and if I could talk to some monk, that would be great. But I really want to understand what it means to be married as a Buddhist practitioner. So that was in May, and I got the answer back. It was June. Thich Nhat Hanh will marry you June 16th. And of course, by that time, I couldn't get my family there, or you know, this was to France, and I didn't even know how to respond to that. We hadn't really planned on getting married yet, but by then it felt like the wheels had really gone in motion, and that we really couldn't stop the spinning of the wheel. So when we arrived there, a couple weeks later, we flew to France like 2 weeks later. again, nobody would meet with us about what the service would be, what the ceremony would be. So we, the morning we were married, it was one of those amazing foggy mornings when there still is a full moon up and the sun up at the same time. I think perhaps you've seen that. And half the community was divided into the groom's family and half into the bride's. And we were in the French countryside outside Lower Hamlet at Plum Village. And there was about 300 people there. And we had 150 in my family walking silently down these curvy roads, walking for about 45 minutes until we met up with the groom's family. And then we became one family. We joined Thich Nhat Hanh for tea. And there was another couple being married that day that were Vietnamese-French. And they were really beautiful and young, really beautiful. They both were wearing like lapis blue silk. And he had a Vietnamese silk headdress on. And they talked nonstop, just nonstop. And occasionally Thay would turn to us and say, "Did you sleep?" And I'd say, "No." Then he'd turn back. And then he turned to us at one point and he said, "Your peace will impact the entire world." He said, "Your excitement would impact the entire world. We will sit here until you're peaceful." So we sat for another hour and a half, I think, until the other couple and ourselves settled down. And then I discovered how we were going to be married with the ceremony, and this is what I wanted to share. I think I marked it here. And this is connected to beloved community. This is what we did prostrations to. We are aware that all generations of our ancestors and all future generations are present in us. So that was a bow and a touch. And I think it was at that moment I really got in touch with what was going on with race and cultural differences. Until that moment, I'd really fallen in love with Larry. But at that moment, I really recognized what else was going on with our union. We are aware of the expectations that our ancestors, our children, and their children have of us. Wow. With that one, we could hardly get off the ground. We were just stuck down there. The energy was so fierce. I could feel my ancestors, Larry's ancestors, like, "Yeah, get to work, get to work, get to work, get to work." We are aware that our joy, peace, freedom, and harmony are the joy, peace, freedom, and harmony of our ancestors, our children, and their children. We are aware that understanding is the very foundation of love. We are aware that blaming and arguing never help and only create a wider gap between us, that only understanding, trust, and love can help us. So that day, June 16, 1994, was a very monumental change in my life, and not just about being married. It was about getting in touch with my ancestors and Larry's ancestors and how to move forward with this kind of commitment that I felt. 1 week later, I took the Bodhisattva vow, and 1 week later, I received my doctorate. So I called it my Reverend Dr. Mrs. Month. And ever since then, I've been doing my best to build beloved community. What Larry and I continue to learn and grow from is the river of love. And the river of love brought us here. So we are grateful for your courage in speaking about brave things and showing up for things that are uncomfortable. So we're really grateful that you have that kind of courage. We really feel that we all need this kind of courage to go forward, because we believe that it's one-to-one, that as we meet each other, that we can build a bright future. So that was a little of my inspiration, too, as I brought a couple of poems from kids. So we were working at Embodied Ethics at my school. So this is from James Van Store, age 10. hope. Hope is a light shining in the corners and crannies of every place on the earth. It is a friend to every human. Hope will keep coming, even in times of sorrow and sadness. Hope is love, peace, and joy all in one. It is the sun and the stars, light. Hope is the sound of every being praying for good time. Hope is a miracle that can work wonders. Hope we will always remember. One day, when all is lost, hope will come, a hero. Hope, here, everywhere, with everyone, every second of the day. It is invisible, but it is here. James Van Store, age 10. And this is Carolyn Terrell, age 10. This was in a class we were doing with embodiment of love. This is on joy. Joy is beautiful. Joy is content. She knows all seen things are temporary, and all unseen things are eternal. If you come to her arms when she holds them out, like a cradle, she will carry you to the moon, and she'll sweep you aloft among the stars. When you look upon her face, she is ancient yet young. Her blue robe blows in the wind as she takes you home. She leaves a mark, though you cannot see it, and you know she will be back. It's Joy by Carolyn Terrell. So working with young people like this, working with people from 44 countries and every religion known and unknown to me, because there were some I'd never heard of, gives me a lot of hope for building beloved community. Seeing how our children walk to school arm in arm, and that's one thing about Asian countries, that you'll see men and young boys holding hands and arm in arm and walking together. But I believe we can do that here too. You wanting to say something yet, or?
Not yet.
So, beloved community, Friday I spoke that we have several choices. We can move away from, we can move in a way that's conflicting, or we can deepen together. And that was our approach this weekend, was to see how we might be able to deepen together. We've had a short concentration. We've had a short time to do that. So hopefully we've left some beautiful flowers and seeds that will continue to sprout with your cultivation of them. But the deepening comes, as I shared Friday, from sharing our stories, of hanging out together, of being together. And we have so many things here that we can share that we have in common. Sharing a path, a practice, and a teacher and a roof. We have all the conditions for happiness and harmony right here to figure out how we can continue to cultivate a beautiful path for each other and our world. The other condition for building beloved community, as I see it, is that we help each other get in touch with our calling, our unique way that we're going to help change the world. And we begin with ourselves, right? We begin right here. But together we can help each other with those callings that need to be attended to. So whether your calling is to garden or to work with kindergartners or to work with elders or teach, paint, compose music, really supporting each other in our work to build a beautiful future. Yeah? You ready to talk? I thought so. Okay.
Or to run a business, or to be in law enforcement, or to be an attorney, or a social worker, or a doctor, or a nurse. And whatever our professional choices might be, what the world needs today is professional contemplatives. And I'm speaking in the context of lay life, life outside the monastery. We have already seen and witnessed what simply professionals can do. We saw that in 2008 on Wall Street. What's required is professionals who dare to have a contemplative life so that they can find in themselves their very best source of humanity. and embody that in their work, in their leadership, in the ways in which they take responsibility for being a human being. I've been really nourished by being here. One of the things that has nourished me is the quality of your silence. I'm Polontius, a Greek philosopher. I mentioned this before, but he's coming up in my mind again. How can a man or woman behold the ineffable beauty within, that remains within? And the only way to do that is through contemplative practice. Because when we are able to behold our own beauty within, we're able to behold beauty without. And as some of our native teachers and friends say, then we're able to walk the beauty way, where beauty is before us and to our left and to our right and behind us and below us and above us. And then the people we meet and the people we see, we're able to bear witness to their own beauty. Our practice overcomes the hindrances of anger and hate. Our practice overcomes doubt, which may be one of the strongest feelings people have in today's modern world. Doubt that we will survive our own humanness. A recent author said that the entire human journey of evolution has been a dance between self-discovery and self-destruction. We still see this dance going on. And we are at a tipping point. Our practice requires that we lean towards self-discovery, that we embody self-discovery, that we have the courage to face Carl Jung in a book called The Undiscovered Self. He wrote right after coming out of a concentration camp. When asked what would the future of the world hold, he said, the future of the world will hold whatever it is in ourselves we do not deal with. Whatever is in our consciousness that we, our deep consciousness that we pretend is not there. Whatever we hide from at the unconscious level will shape our future. I know we think we're all very conscious people, awake. But in fact, the human species is driven by the unconscious. And so our practice is to help us create the space inside of ourselves to be able to meet our own unconscious demons and wonders. And then we learn how to tame those demons and embody those wonders in ourselves and in our society. The Navajo have a similar story about that. You've probably heard it because different teachers have used it, about the two wolves, the grandfather and the grandson, and the question of, you know, which wolf will become stronger. Depends which one we feed. So our practice is to pay attention to what we feed in our unconscious. Do we feed hate? Do we feed anger? Do we feed fear? And how do we do that? And how do we let others do that for us? Or do we feed hope and faith and change and risk. Risking our own transformation. I saw a news article this morning of a young man in, well, not everybody's to be kind of young, but of a young man in Los Angeles who kept seeing this homeless man every day on his way to work. He's a lawyer. And recently he just decided to give that homeless man his house for a year. And he went back to move in, living with his parents. Because he said, I got tired of seeing that man without a house. And I knew I had a backup. And I thought to myself, this is how you practice with information. This is how I practice with information like this, right? Otherwise, it's just news. And what good is that? So then I asked myself, Larry, you have the courage to do that? You have the compassion to do that? If you had a house, would you have the compassion to let someone else have it for a year if you had a backup, you know, backup plan so they could get their life in order? We are so caught in this system, and every system everywhere catches people. That's what systems do. So I'm not trying to pick on the system. I'm saying every system behaves basically the same way. When I was working in theology and teaching and working with local churches and congregations, one of the questions that would come up is, well, how do we, when you look at the church as such a gigantic institution, it's like going to a factory and you see all these wheels and this wheel is turning that wheel, and you can't figure out how to even cut this thing off. The image, the more micro image we have of this is the rat race, and the rat running around in the cage. Willis Harmon, the past director of Institute of Noetic Sciences, who was a friend of mine, wrote a book called Global Mind Change. And he's suggesting we have to learn how to withdraw our legitimacy from institutions and behaviors that no longer serve us. And this can be hard. This can be difficult, especially if my father or my grandfather or my mother or my sister or my brother represent that institution to me. Boy, would I be willing to give up my house for a year? I'm thinking about this because I was walking to get something for my... Look, I'm really cold. It's been a long time since I've been this cold. And so I've been walking around the block where we're staying, thanks to a kind Sangha member, and noticing the number of homeless men primarily downtown. And when they see me, I'm always have a bag, so they think I'm like the new homeless guy on the block. Which is fine. But I've been thinking about that. Would I have the courage? Would I have the view to change my life so someone else could change their life? One of the things I don't want you to forget about what you have here. Peggy's already mentioned how rare it is to have an urban Dharma center. I mentioned earlier I was struck by your silence, your capacity for silence. And there's some great new research on what silence does for the brain, which I think is extremely relevant. First, silence relieves stress and tension. Florence Nightingale once wrote, "Unnecessary noise is the most cruel absence of care that can be inflicted on the sick or the well." Wow. 19th century insight. How did we forget that? How did we miss that? It turns out that noise pollution leads to high blood pressure and heart attacks and other damaging consequences to our physiology. So silence has something to do with our physical well-being. So as you think about your practice, don't just think about it as my silence, my practice. Think about it as the silence, the practice. And when you start to think about it like that, it will radiate outside this building. Into this neighborhood. Without ever having said a word. Secondly, science replenishes our mental resources. So this part of the brain up here is the prefrontal cortex. And what silence does is it helps this part of our brain, which is the part of our brain for high-order decision-making and analysis, it helps this part of our brain rest. So our capacity for making wise choices is enhanced. And so our brain can restore itself if we give it a break. But we seem to be in this pattern of rushing and making decisions ungrounded. It's not that we're not intellectually bright enough to transform our school systems. It is, in my view, that we have not had enough silence. Enough of a pause, enough of slowing down together to sit down and figure out how should this work for the future of our children. We're so trapped in issue-oriented politics that we absolutely miss the system. And silence can give us a chance, our brain a chance to calm down enough to see what systems are going on, and therefore what systems should be enhanced, what systems should be thrown away, and what should be maintained. But unless we slow down enough, our brain cells don't have a chance to gain any insight. And so we just keep repeating the same solutions that don't work over and over and over and over again. Even when new solutions come, we don't appreciate them. There are people working very hard. You're in this room creating new solutions to everything that are of importance at this moment. The other thing about silence, it helps our brain default mode, which is our mode of creativity, resource. Peggy's mentioning that. Fantasizing about the future. Those things really can happen. Insight and creative ideas and innovation are often preceded by silence. And boy, do we need insight. And boy, are we in the need of innovation. And the last little comment from this one study in the Brain Journal is that silence can actually grow our brain cells. So after sitting in sashin for a while, you actually may have more neurons than when you started. And we need all the neurons that we can get. A poem from Pablo Neruda it's been on my mind for a while, that's about this, that I think is really important. And one of the contributions you have here for this neighborhood and beyond it is a place that respects and honors silence. Everything is not about talking. No offense to the talk therapist in the room. But everything's not about talking. Talking's important. Speech is important. Listening is important. But from where do we speak? From where do we listen? This is where silence becomes extremely valuable. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. This one time upon the earth, let's not speak any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be a delicious moment without hurry, without locomotives. All of us would be together in a sudden uneasiness. The fishermen in the cold sea would do no harm to the whales. And the peasant gathering salt would look at his torn hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars of gas, wars of fire, victors without survivors, would put on clean clothing and would walk alongside their brothers and sisters in the shade without doing a thing. What I want should not be confused with final inactivity. Life alone is what matters. I want nothing to do with death. If we weren't unanimous about keeping our lives so much in motion, if we could do nothing for once, perhaps a great silence would interrupt this sadness, this never understanding ourselves and threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth is teaching us when everything seems to be dead, and then everything is alive. Now, I will count to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go.
I wanted to end just with a short 5-minute meditation, because we are going to go. That's the plan, right? Let's be short and guided. So some of the things I've learned from short sits from kids, so you can imagine from the four corners of your zabutong that there's ivy that grows deep into the center of the earth. You can imagine that there's ivy or a green plant that grows from your knees and bum, and there's a hook in the middle of the earth. You can imagine that all four corners of this room are grounded and stable. You can imagine that your favorite mountain is in front of you. Breathing in, know that you are breathing in. Breathing out, know that you are breathing out. Bring your kind attention to your in-breath and follow it all the way. Bring your kind attention to your out-breath, following it in and out. breathing in, I'm aware of the inspirations in my life for practice. I can see or remember or feel or sense my friends and teachers, beloved pets, plants and minerals and animals, anything that inspires me to practice. Breathing out, I smile to my inspiration. Breathing in, aware of inspiration to practice. Breathing out, smiling. Breathing in, I'm aware that my resources for practice are my own peace and joy. Breathing out, I send love to my seeds of peace and joy. Aware of peace and joy in me, sending love. Power sit, kid style. Thank you. Keep your bright faith shiny. Polish your hearts. Oops, sorry. And keep your feet in the river of love. Thank you for your presence and practice.
Well,
take more than one question, or you want to take
Yeah,
just
let's
one?
Take a take couple questions and then see if there's any overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're not, sure, please.
Yeah, how can you best see through your ego and live from awareness?
Okay, another good question. Thank you for your good question. Anybody else?
Our neighborhood yesterday. Did you have any ideas about our relationship to our neighborhood?
Thank you.
So maybe start with those three and see what happens. Okay, so
I'll speak to the walk. You can take the demons.
Okay, I'll start with
the ego.
With the demons, of which we all have. That's the first place to start. And we all have it neurologically, conditioned by evolution. And what that means is that our amygdala, our fear center in the brain, is designed to keep us safe. Now, here's where it gets complicated. Safe from what? So we are hardwired to want to keep ourselves and those close to us safe. The issue is, from what? And because our mind, this is where our mind interacts with our brain, because our mind can come up with things that make us feel unsafe that may not even be there. So for me, this is why mindfulness practice is so very important in dealing with issues of oppression, issues in law enforcement, social work, education, etc. Because our mind can come up with, our minds do come up with things that make us afraid that actually aren't even there. But also, our minds are conditioned by our family, our culture, at the unconscious level. So we have behaviors, assumptions, and patterns we don't even know we have until we run into somebody who calls us on it. And if you are married or have been or have a partner, you know that happens, right? But when we start to look at issues in the larger fabric of society, race, gender, etc., we are really looking at a mix, the interaction between our hardwire and our conditioning. So how Buddhist practice to me is so very relevant, it can train us to become skillful in looking deeply into our conditioning. I had someone come up to me in Columbus, Ohio after a talk, and he said, you didn't talk about Black Lives Matter. Why not? I said, well, one is, that's a whole nother talk. I didn't have time. But my summary is, Black lives have always mattered. That's not the question. The question is, how have they mattered in the last 400 years of this country's history? They have mattered as property. They have mattered as free labor. If we want to talk about mattering, let's talk about the whole thing. Because unless we talk about the whole thing, we miss what has to be changed. I understand the motivation of that movement, and it needs to continue because it's spotlighting law enforcement issues, whether that's the police officer or a citizen, like in the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. But I suggest a book. It's called it's the post-slavery
syndrome.
Post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Portland author.
The author is from Portland, where we were just at a few weeks ago. It is very good. And if you're an African American, you'll know most of this stuff already because you have to. But you can forget. Remember, 400 years, you can forget. We have to stay in the whole picture because it's the whole picture that's our burden. And it's the whole picture that has to be uplifted and transformed. Another book that you will find helpful because it has some practical exercises in it is Mindfulness in Anti-Oppression Pedagogy. It's very good in terms of how to have conversations with people, with ourselves, about privilege, about race, about gender, about ethnicity, and the issues our mind brings to the process. So it's both hardwire, softwire, and mindfulness to me gives us a level of consciousness so we can recognize both, the hardwiring and the softwiring. The other thing our practice can do is it can actually transform our hardwiring. Mm-hmm. Now this is the revolutionary edge of contemplative practice in neuroscience. You want to talk about?
Are we out of time? Okay. I wanted to speak to the ego first. For me, I just love everything, so I don't get mad at my ego. But it's love that's been the way through for me, is really staying awake to love and feeling when my heart gets hard, and staying awake, so I don't get lazy with loving myself. But love has really been the way through to melt things down for me, and transform some of the difficulties. Like Larry said, we've worked really hard with some stuff, and I know all of us here have, with our events in our life and our experiences that could have shaped my whole life, could have shaped your whole life if you hadn't worked with it. So this we need to celebrate. This we need to look at too, at what we've done and continue to make progress. After our house was bombed, I couldn't even be around. I couldn't light a candle because of the smoke would trigger so much stuff in me. The thought of someone trying to kill me that didn't know me had me crippled. And I was determined to practice and grateful for my teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, "I'm sorry it happened, and don't put your energy there. I'm sorry it happened, and it did. Now what are you going to do with your life? What are you going to do with your precious life?" Mind you, he doesn't have that attitude. He doesn't say much. But the walk was beautiful, and we even walked too fast because it was so cold. And I can't even imagine how wonderful it had been if we could have even walked slower and taken more time, because it was so beautiful walking in your neighborhood. And how many of you that walked felt that? It wasn't just me. Yeah, it was beautiful, wasn't it? Yeah, we walked arm in arm, slowly but not as slow as Thich Nhat Hanh would have liked, because it was cold. And there's this amazing park right out here with nobody in it. So I would just brainstorm that playfully of what you might want to do, because there's like nobody around. So I'd wonder about that. There's people behind those doors. And mind you, in Wisconsin, this used to happen. In summer, I know the population quadrupled. But you know, I can come up with some ideas, even free lemonade, I don't know. But meeting people in that park where there's so much creativity and movement. But I think you'll find out. I know our monks and nuns, when we were living at the monastery, we took food door to door. We made these Vietnamese mooncakes, and door to door met people. And the first year, people were startled. The second year, I think they'd all spoken to each other. And the third year, they started talking to us. So some of it is patience, but going to them. But then seeing what they want. We're finding out in Vashon Island, they want to look at suicide. So we're going to try to help the community with suicide. That's what they came to us to look at. So what are they interested in? Maybe it's peaceful kids, maybe not. I don't know. The kids might be the way in. They might want to know about, we call this ninja training. That helped me get kids. So if they know there's a ninja training academy right here, you might get some attention.
The other thing that along those lines is, a few years ago, we were talking to a young new monastic in Plum Village, and he was asked by a younger person, why did he become a monk? And he said, "It's the closest thing I could find to being a Jedi Knight." So to me, one of the things to keep in mind in a new situation, in a new community, and with people who are not familiar with the Buddhist tradition in general, let alone any specific Buddhist tradition, be very mindful of your language. Be mindful of your dress. And be mindful of your energy. Pay really close attention to these things, because you're not selling something. You're being something.
It's your presence.
It's your presence that finally matters in human interaction, whomever you're interacting with. And so, and start small. In the community development work that I did in Chicago and other places around the world, but Find allies in the neighborhood, and there doesn't have to be a lot. You can just start with one or two, three people that you can talk to, learn from, and they can connect you to other people that you can talk to and learn from. But don't, and you already know this, but don't go from the perspective of I have something to give you that you need. Because the other great thing about Buddhism is we know we don't. Everybody already is beautiful within and without. And our practice is to remove the veils of ignorance so we can see that in ourselves and see that in one another. When I left yesterday, I was going to give a talk on the five hindrances until I realized I was coming down with the flu last night. And someone asked me about this on the way out yesterday, how to practice with the hindrances. You'll find it, sensory, but it says sensual in all the sutras. I disagree with that language because, as Westerners who, and especially in the U.S., kind of still in the eighth grade, when we say sensual, we all think about sex. That's not the teaching. The teaching is about sensory, what our eyes desire, what our nose desires, what our tongue wants, what our body wants, what our mind wants. Nose, tongue, body, mind. Overcoming our attachment to being driven by these things. I'm just, coming back from Bangkok, I'm just stunned when I see, TV shows that specialize in used stuff. It's like junk. Not junk, but junk. And garages and garages full of stuff that no one knows what to do with, so we just keep reselling it to one another. like there's something not right about that.
Okay. Yeah. I think we're out of time. Yeah, we're out of time.
There's something not right about that.
Well, thank you, Larry and Peggy. And thank you so much for being here this weekend. I want to also thank our partners in bringing Larry and Peggy here, Blooming Heart Sangha.